Someone once said that fish are too valuable to be caught only once, and these days a lot of anglers practice catch and release. Let's talk about the best practices for just that topic on this episode of Fishful Thinker, the podcast. I'm Chad LaChance, and you're listening to Fishful Thinker, the podcast. All things fishful, all the time. Hey guys, Chad LaChance here. Thanks so much for tuning in. As always, I appreciate it very much. And of course, also, as always, brought to you by the fine folks at Sportsman's Warehouse. You can visit them at sportsmans.com, get shipped to store, and then visit them at any one of 140 plus stores nationwide. So, you know, we do our spring shopping there. Guys, it's March. Speaking of spring, it's nearing the end of March, actually, at this point. In fact, it's Easter weekend. Happy Easter to those of you that celebrate Easter out there. And it's also the time of year where a lot of the fishermen start coming out of the woodwork. And maybe you live in the South where you never went in hiding in the first place. Or maybe you don't ice fish like me and you are just coming out of the woodwork. But the situation is that the weather's starting to warm up, stuff's starting to barely green up, although it's snowing at my house right now. Spring snow is a good thing around here. And it's the time when we're starting to see a lot of anglers. And my home lake that I live on is getting a tremendous amount of pressure for this early in the season. And I think it has more to do with the fact that the nice days we've been having have been coupled with some good trout stocking over the last couple of years. I'd like to thank the biologists at CPW for that one. We had a long talk about it a couple of years ago, and we were able to provide them some information on return to creel, and they started stocking trout a whole bunch, and that's fantastic. But we see a lot of them in the lake. And this time of year, almost annually, I start getting a few fish that'll show up that I see around the lake, and I live overlooking the lake, so I can see what's going on day in and day out at the lake. I also guide on the lake, and I recreate on the lake, so I spend a lot of time here. I'm pretty tuned in to what's going on at my home lake. And it's a couple thousand surface acres, and I still get, every spring, fish come cruising in here as the angling pressure ramps up, and they show signs of having been caught and are in poor shape. And the other day, I had a pretty good-sized trout, probably a 20-incher, maybe 2 weeks ago. I was standing on the edge of the bank fishing, and this one came cruising right down the bank right in front of me, and he was absolutely covered in saprolegnia. The whole front half of the fish was covered in saprolegnia. Now, if you're not familiar with saprolegnia, basically what it is it's a skin condition. It's a parasitic condition that is affects fish and causes this white kind of almost moldy stuff to grow on them. You may have seen it in a fish tank. If you go into a fish tank store, a fish store, and you ask them about your fish in your fish tank that's got ick, this white fuzz on it, that's a version of saprolegnia as I understand it. But at any rate, I posted it on the Fishful Thinker Facebook page that, oh, the annual first fish of the year with saprolegnia came cruising in. And I was more commenting on it being the annual thing, not complaining about this particular trout that was affected with it. But it struck a chord with our viewers and our social following. And next thing you know, a bunch of people were asking me to do this podcast. So I'm going to do this podcast today on the best practices for catch and release fishing. Now, let me throw a couple things out in the beginning. First of all, no, I am not going to preach to you. You do you. I say that all the time about fishing. If you're within the bounds of the law and ethics, then do your best. But if you're trying to release fish consistently, as a very high percentage of anglers do, then there's some things that you should probably pay attention to that will help you out a whole bunch. And in preparation for doing this, and because I fish for a living and have for 20 years, I've had lots of conversations, but one person specifically is a doctorate in fish physiology and teaches fish physiology literally around the entire world at colleges. So I figured he would be a pretty good resource for catch and release fishing, especially because he is one of the most avid anglers I know as well. So this is a guy that knows fish inside and out at the highest level. And he's a perfect resource for me. And he chose not to be named, and so I'm not going to name him right here, but he's a doctor, and fish physiology is his thing. So I got the intel from him, and then a lot of this is going to be based on just being in, on, and around water since I was a wee little kid and watching how fish get handled or not handled and being a fishing guide for the last 20 years. So I'm kind of putting it all together right here. And again, I'm not going to preach to you. I'm just going to tell you what I know. And the other thing I'm going to throw out there right at the very beginning, I don't care if you're the highest level pro or the biggest noob out there, you're going to mishandle some fish. It's going to happen. We all drop fish. We all have things. Fish are hard to hold on to. If you hold on to them hard enough, then you squeeze them and that's bad for them, blah, blah, blah. You're going to make some fish handling mistakes. This is more addressed. This podcast is more focused on teaching you best practices for ensuring that a lot of the fish that you release are done successfully. And there are several reasons why fish don't survive catch and release fishing. And that's what we're going to talk about addressing here today. So first off, back to my first thing about the trout with the saprolegnia or ick or whatever you want to call it on this fish. It was very evident in looking at this fish that he had been caught and mishandled and released. And that I see, especially after almost every really busy weekend here at the lake. Typically, you'll start seeing it about Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, midweek or a little after. We'll start seeing fish that'll come drifting in behind my house to the point that the eagles will station here and being prepared to eat them, the bald eagles, as will some vultures and a fair number of seagulls and the raccoons at night. And so if there's that many of them come and drift again on the prevailing current, well, that should tell you there's a bunch of them that are being mishandled out there. In some cases, it's obvious. A fair number of them come in with fishing line cut off where somebody did what they were correctly told, which is you don't unhook a fish that's very deep hooked. So they cut the line, let the fish go. That's fine, but the fish still died. Others are from the saprolegnia, as I just mentioned, and a few other things. But at the end of the day, there's a fair bit of delayed mortality that comes in here. And delayed mortality is what happens when you put a fish back, you let him go, and he swims off, quote unquote, swam off strong, one of my least favorite sayings of all time. I always automatically assume when somebody blurts that out that they know in the back of their own mind that they did not do a good job of getting that fish back in the water. Swam away strong is the biggest misnomer in fishing. I've seen fish with one whole fillet cut off the side swim away, because it was dropped overboard. So this fish have a very simple nervous system, and they can swim away, but that does not mean they survive, and that's a key thing. And so delayed mortality, according to extensive research, is the number one killer of fish, but it's probably not, most of it's not from what the obvious things that we would think of that would do that to the fish. So since we started with saprolegnia, let's start there first. Saprolegnia occurs or can occur from any disruption to the slime coat on the fish. The slime coat is there to protect the fish from bacteria and virus and parasites and things like that. It makes them slippery, hard to hold on to, but it also protects them. And the specific thing that I see with saprolegnia is typically in trout. I don't see it very much here on any of the other species. And for the record, I have smallmouth bass, walleyes, perch, bluegills, crappies, a few largemouth bass, and lots of trout in the lake that I'm on here. And so I see a range of species. Saprolegnia for me is what I've seen most commonly tied with trout. And the general MO, according to my doctorate buddy, is the smaller the scales are on any fish, the more susceptible they are to saprolegnia. So a trout being the most prime example, they have teeny tiny little scales. It's actually a sign of evolution, as I understand it. The fish is a more evolved species versus, say, something like a pike or a carp even, especially a carp, that have great big scales. And therefore, it's a sign that that's a more durable species. And anyone that's ever been around carp realizes that you can abuse them and they live. Pike, same thing. They're hard to kill. But a trout, if you look at him funny, he can die. So that's because of their evolutionary processes, I'm told. But the easy way for you as an angler to determine that is think about the fish you're handling. If his scales are small, he's probably delicate and you need to be careful with him. And that's generally what it comes down to. But what I see with trout, and I see this one a ton so far this spring,
the biggest culprit to them is sand, rocks, and gravel. And it's because they're hard to land. And so my lake is currently closed to boats. So everyone that's fishing is fishing from the bank. And I walked the bank the other day. There was probably 15 guys out. I probably saw 10 fish get caught. And of those 10 fish, 8 of them were drug up on the bank by the angler intentionally as a way to land the fish. And even if they're just partially up on the bank, they're up on the mud or the gravel, the dry ground. They're not in the water. And that's almost the worst thing, according to my doctorate buddy, that is almost the worst thing you can do to any fish, especially a trout, is drag it over anything abrasive. Okay, so if you think about it, how he described it to me, if it will skin your knee, it will kill your fish. And so if you kneel down on any of these rocks around here, I promise it'll skin your knee. Well, it's going to take the slime coat right off the fish. So right off the bat, if you drag a trout up on the bank, or for that matter, put it in a nylon landing net as opposed to a rubberized landing net or a cotton landing net, you're going to scrape that slime coat up severely. And that's not the only cause of saprolegia. I want to point that out. Anything that disrupts the slime coat, i.e. the hatchery stocking process is possible, is going to potentially be bad for the fish. Well, dragging one on the bank is about the worst thing you can do. And I see it routinely, not occasionally. I see it all the time. Anytime there's people bank fishing for trout. My general answer is if you're going to drag it up on the bank in the sand, put it on your stringer or in your cooler and take it home and eat it. Because even if it does swim away, it's going to have a very high chance that the slime coat has been significantly removed and the fish is not going to survive in the long run. And if it does, it's going to be sick for a while. So that's the first thing I say with any fish, but especially with trout. Anything abrasive is very bad for the fish. That goes for rocks, that goes to some degree to boat carpet, although most boat carpet is soft enough. And I actually discussed that exact thing with my doctorate buddy who has fished in my boat and he convinced me that, hey, you leave slime coat on the carpet, you can see it on the carpet. Well, then it came off of the fish. However, it's not as abrasive as some other things. And even biologists, when they're handling fish that they're going to release for sampling and things like that, they wear wool gloves because it gives them a little bit of grip over the fish without completely removing the slime coat, as opposed to, you know, dry hands or anything else. So there's an old saying, you know, get your hands wet before you handle trout. Well, okay, that's definitely going to help, but your hands aren't really horrible for fish. But abrasiveness is, and that's what you've got to worry about. Jewelry, even he mentioned, could be a thing on fish. So first thing we want to do if we're going to try to release fish is not drag them in sand, gravel, rock, anything like that. Second thing, and this is a huge one, delayed mortality from overexhaustion and overexhaustion or blood chemistry issues. And blood chemistry issues change from fish to fish, as does exhaustion levels, as does the temperature of the water. So all things being equal, the colder the water, the easier chance the fish will have to recover. If the water is very warm, the less chance the fish will have to recover. And also, just for the record, the more chance that saprolegnia will set in on trout, the warmer the water. So you can't overfight fish. And I see guys do this all the time as well, particularly in my guiding. I see guys, one of two things with guys in a boat when I'm guiding them. Either they want to yank that thing in the boat so fast that it thinks it was abducted by aliens, or they won't put enough pressure on it to get it to the boat in a reasonable time frame. And I'm the first guy to understand that fishing with light line is a great way to catch a lot of fish. It's a great sporting thing. I understand line class records, this, that, and the other. I'm also the first guy to say that it is very, very difficult on the fish. It's you're purposely making it harder to land the fish. Therefore, it's going to take you longer. Therefore, your fish is going to be more exhausted. So you need to be cognizant of how long you're fighting fish. As a general rule, that's one of the reasons I like heavier tackle, because I can get more bites with light tackle, but I'm much easier on fish with heavier tackle. And being easy on fish is the thing. I'll catch somewhere this coming season, I'll catch somewhere around 2,000 fish. Well, if even 10% of those fish are mishandled or overplayed, that's a big enough number to matter. And in some years, when we're really fishing a lot, we'll be upwards of 5,000 fish in one season between myself and clients, which means I handle a lot of fish, which means we need those fish in the boat in a hurry or on the bank, whatever we're doing, quicker than not, if at all possible. So I'm not a huge fan of 7X tippet. I know you can land big fish on it. I know all that. But I also know that you can't put any pressure on them. And that's not good. I'm not a big fan of, 4-pound test for wipers. And I see that kind of stuff too. I also want to point out that we caught a wiper on film. Ronnie Castiglione caught it with me on film that was in the 10 or 11 pound range. Caught it on 6-pound test fluorocarbon. And it was, I think, 43 seconds from the time he set the hook to the time I netted the fish. It's a 10-pound wiper on 6-pound test. You just have to fight fish intelligently. And I'll maybe do another podcast about how to do that. But I've caught some really big saltwater fish on some really light tackle for the size of the fish. Typically ones I didn't intend to hook on that tackle, including an 80-pound drum on 10-pound braid. So, it's doable, but it's not necessarily good for the fish. So I'm of the opinion, if you're going to release everything, use the heaviest line that you can present your lure with, because you can be the easiest on the fish that way. So the next thing you got to consider is not just how long it takes you to get that fish to the boat, and again, in warmer water, it's fish exhaust quicker, and that's important. Trout especially, but any fish, if it's warm for their range, will expire quicker. A walleye will expire quickly in 90-degree water. Trout won't even make it alive in 90-degree water. So again, it's relative. So other than just getting the fish to the boat in a hurry by fighting it or getting it to the bank in a hurry and not playing it to pure exhaustion, the next thing is, how long is that fish out of the water? And that's the other one I see a lot of, especially these days. And this is it's turning into more and more of a pet peeve of mine is photos. Listen, people, you don't have to take photos of every fish you caught. I get it. You caught a fish. You surely don't have to take 10 photos of every fish you got. And we've all seen that Facebook post where a guy catches one fish and there's 12 pictures of it. I hope you ate it, because the time it took you to take those 12 pictures, I promise you, you made life very difficult on that fish. And so here's how it goes. For us, as a TV show, I have no choice but to film and take photos of fish. So we spend a lot of time with those fish, whether it shows up on air or not, in a landing net, a specific kind of landing net in the water, letting that fish revive. And I mean, it might be for minutes at a time between shots. And I hate doing that while we're filming. But if I took too much time to get a fish to the boat, or it just took time to get the fish to the boat, or maybe it took me a minute to get it unhooked, I will keep it in the landing net and in the water until I can see that it's relaxing again, and then take another swing at getting it unhooked or getting it released, as the case might be. And I'll tell you about that landing net here as we get closer to the end, but I want to focus on the point here. And that fish needs to be unbound up to where his gills can go. He's fully submerged and he's not being held, if at all possible, because their instinct will be to continuously fight you if you're holding him. And we see people holding fish by the tail, or the peduncle is the correct term, and they wiggle it back and forth and all that. That's better than nothing, but it's not as good as a great big landing net that the fish can swim unhindered in and can just relax. And you can watch their gill covers and get a pretty good idea of how well the fish is breathing. But it's kind of like this. Let's say, well, I can hold my breath for a minute. Okay, that's great. But can you jog a quarter of a mile and then hold your breath for a minute? Because that's what you're asking the fish to do. So I'm of the opinion they need to be back in the water as fast as possible, even if it's for a couple minutes in between while you go to get, your camera ready or whatever the case might be. A live well is another possibility as well, so long as your live well is circulating and the temperature in that live well is similar to the water in the lake. The lake is still better, but the live well, if you're going to do that, the biggest thing is keep track of the fact that the live well needs to be similar in temperature. If you've ever had a fish tank, you know you acclimate fish before you put them in the fish tank because of the temperature difference, and they're cold-blooded, and there's only so much they can do about changing temperature in a hurry. I also want to point out, though, that we unintentionally, in a tournament where you get penalized for it, no less, killed a 5+ pound smallmouth because we caught, there was a requirement in the tournament that you had ice in your live well. We had just put ice in the live well, and then we catch a 5-pound smallmouth. That smallmouth came out of 93 degree water on Kentucky Lake. We put that smallmouth in the live well, caught him quickly, no problem. It's a tournament, we're in a hurry, we got heavy tackle. We get him in the net, give a quick glance, throw him in the live well, done. I open the live well, not 3 minutes later, that fish is stone dead because the temperature difference of the live well. So if your live well's been running around on recirculate for the last 3 hours, it is nowhere near the temperature of the lake and is not a good place to put your fish to revive. So let the fish have time to revive and catch their breath and get their act together before you spend any real time with them. And that's really what I see a lot of these days. The two number one things, or the two, I guess can't really have two number one things. The two main things I see is either dragging fish up on the bank and then they're covered in rocks and gravel and their slime coats tore up, or keeping fish out of water too long. Those are the two biggest things. And a quick splash, this one I see a lot. Oh, I'll splash them in the water real quick and pull them up. That's great, but let me hold you underwater for a minute and then let you get a quarter of a breath of air and then hold you back underwater. It's not going to be enough. So you have to be cognizant of giving that fish time. I mentioned blood chemistry as well. The length of the fight and the time that the fish is out of water, their chemistry gets out of whack. And especially with hybrid species, this can be an issue. Basically, you might know it in the human as lactic acid, when your muscles get burning. Well, the fish do that as well. Lactic acid builds up anytime there's a fight or flight response. And hybrid species are even worse for it. So wipers, muskies, things like that, they are very difficult to recover their blood chemistry because there's not even a naturally occurring fish in the first place. So delayed mortality amongst wipers is very high, and because of their blood chemistry. And you add that to the fact that it's a really strong fish, that makes them a little harder to land. So yeah, they have big scales and they're fairly durable in that regard, but their kryptonite, so to speak, is their blood chemistry. So you have to be cognizant of that. The longer you fight a fish or the harder time you had getting a fish to the boat, the quicker you need to be about keeping it in the water, the more diligent you need to be about keeping it in the water with its head fully submerged and its gill covers unbound. That's very important. The gill covers have to be able to work. Y'all may have heard that a shark can't breathe. He has to constantly swim. A shark cannot stop swimming because he doesn't have gill covers. He has no way to pump water across his gills. Well, if you hold the gill covers closed, a trout or a bass or a walleye has no way to get any water flow across their gills either, or their gill rakers. So that's really important. So those things go together. The quickness of the fight, and again, the warmer the water, the better. The quicker you need to fight the fish, the quicker you need to be about getting that fish unhooked and dealt with in the boat. And since I just mentioned unhooking, I'm going to go here real quick. And this one's going to be really controversial because this one is something that is counterintuitive, but I think we've all seen it as well. And it's the one thing that I see this one commonly between fly fishermen and conventional fishermen. And that is the use of a treble hook on a lure or something like that. And it goes down to what's known as hooking mortality. And it's basically like this. That hook gets hooked in some place bad on the outside of the fish, right? So the fish bites your lure. Now you got a treble hook in his lip. And then another treble hook swings around and gets him on the side somewhere and pokes a hole in him. And you think, oh, okay, well, whatever, and da-da-da-da-da. Well, here's the thing on that. According to, I believe it was Cornell University that he quoted, very small percentage of fish die from hooking wounds. They die from delayed mortality. Fish are very, very durable when it comes to their ability to deal with being cut or stabbed or whatever. They get attacked by birds. We've all seen fish with bird strikes on them that healed up. They get attacked by each other. We've all seen fish with that. I've seen pike with whole bites missing out of them that healed up. We've all seen fish with missing one or both eyes. I've caught fish with a gill raker ripped out that healed up fine and the gill raker's gone, partially gone. They do well, surprisingly well, considering how easy they die from other things, with the hooking mortality. That is not what gets most fish. The one kind of hooking mortality that does get fish is a swallowed situation. And so let's discuss what happens if a fish swallows your bait. The problem is we're all taught to cut the line and let the fish go, don't dig it out. But invariably what I see, particularly with younger anglers, or newer anglers, I should say, first thing they want to do is try to get it out. If you land a fish and you look at it and you realize it swallowed your stuff, don't even try. Just cut it off immediately and let the fish go, and preferably without a photograph or anything else. And when I say cut it off as short as you can. It's ironic that a fair number of them that swallow stuff that come in behind my place dead, there's typically 6 or 8 or 10 inches of line coming out of their gullet. If you're gonna cut it off, cut it as short as you can cut it, and that will be a much better situation. But you can't try to dig at it and then let the fish go. If it's hooked in the gills themselves, I've seen them stop bleeding very, very quickly. And if you think about certain species of fish, and we're talking about in the gill rakers, so the actual red parts of the gills that you can feel with your fingers, you look down at the fish's mouth, those gill rakers, with a lot of species of fish, they're subject to wounding from other things. If you think about it, how many fish eat crabs, and how many fish eat crayfish, and how many fish eat birds, and everything the fish eats wants to fight back. That crayfish was alive when he caught it, and he's got big giant grabbers and pokers and everything else. Fish can heal up from that better than what you think, and that's at least what I'm told by the biologist. I've seen it in the tank, or by the physiologist, I should say. I've seen it in fish tanks. I've seen it in live wells. Not all of them will, especially with the gill raker injury, but a lot of them will. But the more you dig at it and try to get the hook out, the worse you are. And so here's my advice if you're a guy that wants to fish a lot and you really want to do a good job of taking care of your fish, get a pair of side cutters, long, thin side cutters. And if you hook fish with a crankbait or a jerkbait or something like that, and just reach in and snip the hook off, just leave the rest of the hook in the fish, snip that one hook off and leave it right where you found it and get your bait out, change your hook out later. Don't grab it with your pliers and start trying to get it out. If it's stuck in the gill rakers or down in the esophagus, don't try to dig it out. Cut it off and go from there. And I've even seen some tournament organizations that require you have side cutters in your boat just for that purpose. Incidentally, mine get used more often than not on people that get hooked. That's how I get hooks off of lures when they're hooked with it. So side cutters are a very, very handy thing to have in your tackle box or your boat. It's a great safety thing to have, but it's also a safety thing for the fish. So a fish that's hooked on the side or foul hooked or something like that, the chances of him dying from that are very slim compared to all the other things we've already talked about. So it looks bad, and intuitively we're like, oh man, but it's not nearly as bad as you think. And the same thing with leaving stuff in them. Fish shed all kinds of stuff in a hurry, in the same way that a dog's stomach will pull away from bones and things if he swallows. Why a dog can eat raw bones, but their stomach is designed for it. Same thing with fish. They're fairly surprising in that regard. But there's certain things that will go ahead and get them. So keep those in mind all the time. And then the other thing I'll throw out there, if you're going to leave stuff in fish, it'll rust out in a hurry. I've caught a whole pile of fish with hooks and line coming out their butt. I've caught them with old rusted off hooks stuck all over in them. I caught a trout up at Delaney Buttes that had 9 flies broke off in his face. And I caught him on a big giant jerkbait. And the flies were tiny, and his whole mouth was full of them. The whole lip was full of these little flies where he had broke off a whole bunch of dudes that were midge fishing on fly tackle. And then I landed him. It wasn't even that big of a fish, but it didn't seem to bother him any having all those little flies in his face. Just for the record, I kept him in the net and plucked them all out, and I still have them. Most of them were still usable. But again, we keep them in the net. And I promised you I'd say something about the net. This is not a plug for a brand of nets, but it's a plug for a style of nets. I use Fraybill Conservation Series nets for a reason. They have a big flat bottom in them. It is not just a tapered bag. It's a flat bottom net. and it's fully rubberized. And so the flat bottom is important because the fish is not bound. It's not like you put a pantyhose over them like with some of those long, skinny, old school nets. Sure, the net's stretchy, but it's still stretching tight around, pulled down around the fish. So I don't like the pure rubber nets either because I believe they're hard to net fish with, and I've seen fish jump out of them a lot. But the conservation series nets are rubberized. They're rubber coated with a big bottom on them. And I've got them in a whole range of sizes, from little ones for stream fishing, for trout, all the way up to great big ones for, you know, for big stuff, big walleyes and stuff like that. And it allows me, because I do this for a living, I very often am holding fish in the water for a long period of time and letting them regroup. And these nets are perfect for that. There's other companies that make them. That's the one I use. But the conservation series is a fantastic series of nets if you're really serious about taking care of fish. And I want to throw out one other thing here towards the end of this podcast. Eat some dang fish. I have no problem with people eating fish. The only problem I have is when people mishandle fish, and particularly just through pure negligence, and then try to let them go. I'd rather see you put it in the live well and take it home and eat it, because otherwise you're just wasting it. And fish that are exhausted, even if they swim away and have either delayed mortality, or maybe they swim away and they're so weak because you fought them. If you've ever done any saltwater fishing, you fight a fish very long, you'll notice a lot of times we'll have dolphins show up at the boat. Dolphins are smart enough not to bite the fish while you're fighting him. They'll follow it around, but they won't bite it. But they'll eat that thing about 5 seconds after it hits the water when you release it, because they know that the fish is slow and easy to catch. I saw a crayfish walk up and grab a fish that was released by a guy that was exhausted. The guy put the trout in the water, and it's kind of laying half on its side and half not after a long fight on a light tippet. And literally, crayfish just walked over and grabbed this thing. And the fish had no wherewithal to defend itself. So yeah, he did his job trying to release it. But he had overfought it, took a bunch of pictures. I watched him do it. Put it in the water, and crayfish grabbed it immediately. And so he might as well put it on a stringer and took it home. The effect would have been the same. So again, I'm not judging anybody. It's just, I think a lot of people don't realize the effects of either abrasive material on fish or long fights, or they're not cognizant of how long they have a fish out of water. And I've had the one benefit of watching myself for nearly 20 years on video, and I have a timer on the video, right? So I can see exactly how long stuff goes. And there's really no need to fight fish for any length of time. For one, in any kind of reasonable tackle. For two, there's no reason to have a fish in the boat for a minute. And I sit here all spring long and watch people behind my house take 10 pictures of an 8-inch smallmouth bass. The fish is out of water the whole time, and I oftentimes will start a timer. After it gets about the 30-second mark, I'll go ahead and start a timer just to see, have a discussion with a buddy or a neighbor. And it's very common. I see people with fish out of water for 3 minutes. You might as well take that thing home and eat it, because it is not going to live at that point. It's not going to die right when you drop it in the water, but it's going to die very shortly thereafter. So that's all. I'm not trying to be preachy, people. I just feel like if you want to release fish, you need to be cognizant of these things, if at all possible. So summarize a couple quick things. Keep them off of anything abrasive, for one. For two, the expedite your fight on your fish if at all possible. And two, even more importantly, expedite how much time you have that fish out of water. And if you're going to have it out of water, make sure that it has plenty of time to revive in between. Give it a few minutes in between to get its act back together before you have to deal with it some more. That's going to help you a lot. Both of those issues are made worse the warmer the water gets. So if we're talking about July, August, even bass have a hard time at that scenario, which is why that tournament I told you about earlier, right? They forced us to put ice in the live well. The water was in the 90-degree range. For the record, they have since outlawed tournaments in that time frame altogether, because it's hard on fish when the water's 90 degrees. It's hard to have successful catch and release. So that's my deal. Get a nice net, carry some side cutters, long nose pliers for sure. I'm not a huge fan of de-hookers, but they're good if you're dealing with small fish. And don't be afraid to eat some fish now and then. I guarantee you, even if you don't like fish, somebody you know will eat one. If you've got a fish that is very clearly going to die, there's no shame in that. Fishing is a contact sport, no matter how you look at it. Just take them home and eat it. And to that end, I believe bass should be released if at all possible, blah, blah, blah. I had a client that had an unlucky hook, and again, it's a contact sport. fish was clearly, it bit a great big topwater. It got in its face all goofy and tore the fish up really bad. Fish was dead at the boat. It had bled out by the time it got to the boat. It was an 18-inch smallmouth, and I ate that sucker because I refused to let it go to waste. So I appreciate you guys. I don't generally get very, very preachy, so to speak, but I feel like this is an important one. If you guys have questions on this one, any of this, please email me, chat@fishfulthinker.com, because I will happily, if I don't have your answer, your scientific answer, not based on something else, I will reach out to the doctor himself and get the answer for you. So I appreciate it. If you want to join the conversation on social media, @fishfulthinker, that's Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and especially our YouTube channel. I'm actually going to do a video here once it warms up a little bit on some fish handling. I just wanted to get this out there early because season is just getting started and I want it to be out there while it's fresh. So thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you'll tune into Fishful Thinker on Altitude Sports and World Fishing Network. This has been Fishful Thinker, the podcast.